restart this seminar again, but his talk was very complicated, and in a sense, but the message was very straightforward, and it was a great challenge to JST, because JST is a governmental funding agency, and in a sense, old establishment in history, but also at the same time, JST is doing some funding for the liaisoning science and the society. So ask anyone to make raise hand and to make questions. So.
Could you speak up?
Speak up a little bit. Yeah, it's being recorded.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your always provocative talk. The question is about the transhumanism and transhumanism enhancement budget and the military. Because you talked about we are now facing a huge, in a sense, of budget cut because of the end of the Cold War and something like that. So these money are not spent for the media anymore. So there is a space, in a sense, for spending this money for enhancement or transhumanism, for instance. But it seems to me that you didn't talk about the role of the military in enhancement.
Yeah.
For instance, in the United States, DARPA spent much money for research on robotics.
Yes.
Or creating a medicine for curing PTSD soldiers.
Yeah.
Or some medicine for making soldiers wake up always.
Yes.
Do not make them sleep and can't
fight. Yeah.
And so on and so forth. So still, it seems to me that the military is still working in this area.
I agree. I actually agree with you on that. And in fact, if you look at most of the sorts of transhumanist things that are on the table now, including issues having to do, one thing I'm involved in, for example, is the idea that if global warming got so bad and people had to leave the Earth, whether it would be possible to live in a spaceship that never has to settle down anywhere, that could be self-fueling, right? The energy source could always be renewed within the machine itself. The U.S. Defense Department is supporting that, okay, among others. What I don't think you have at the moment with the Defense Department is the kind of focus, the kind of overarching, because see, the Cold War was a very clear thing in a way, right? I mean, it was basically about two ideologies in battle to control the entire planet. And that led to a very global way of looking at things and actually a very formalized way of understanding what one needed to do. And the Cold War was pretty much conducted in a pretty rigorous way with regard to arms and things like that. But now we live in a situation where it's not clear what exactly is the battle, right? If you think about it, from a military standpoint, the conventional foes, like another nation state like the Soviet Union, isn't really what's being the battle, right? We're always talking about terrorism and stuff like this, and the terrorists operate in very different, strange kinds of ways, which are not necessarily connected with increasing the level of science and technology, except maybe at the level of surveillance, okay? So I think in a sense, while there is military investment, as you say, in the enhancement stuff, it is not at the levels that stuff was being done at the Cold War. And of course it was through the Cold War we got the internet and a lot of the stuff that we're still living on now. But because I don't think that the foe has been so clearly conceptualized, and certainly not in a way where, because the Cold War was conducted as a science war, basically, right? The US and the USSR were basically in some kind of science race, where the space race was part of it, arms race was another part of it. But this kind of, whatever kind of world conflict we're in now, doesn't quite have that character. And so I don't think that yet justifies the levels of funding that were given in the peak of the Cold War period. See now, what I said about the National Science Foundation in 2002, if you read that document on the converging technologies, it's quite upfront by saying we need to reconceptualize the big national goal for science. But remember, this document was largely composed even before 9/11 happened. Okay, and that really just changed the whole way of looking at things, and it's not clear any longer that big science, high-tech solutions are really the way to go on stuff like this from the military. So there is investment. I'm not denying your point, but it doesn't yet justify the levels that gets us back to the Cold War.
So I have a question. You, in a sense, again, emphasize the importance of fungibility of science and the public engage in the science making. But our memory of this period is that OM cult attack. So this is a kind of kitchen science they did. And so if the public engaged into the kind of science making, it's not always safe. And
so
this can be a kind of amateur terrorism. So this can be a kind of a very dangerous thing. And another thing is, another aspect of the current situation is the story of GM or gene modified organization. Mm-hmm. And these stuffs are enhancing the life. But EU and the Japanese have some concern because it's also from late lessons, but also GMO, in a sense, the monopolized by Monsanto.
Yes.
So this story is made by Monsanto, and this. So what you said is, if we make some mistake, this is a kind of simply excuse of huge capital to expand their profit, and it is something we are observing. So what you said is theoretically correct, but in reality, what is happening in our world is just opposite. So I rather side with European Union's late lesson story, because this kind of conservatism was kind of our method to survive. And also, this is not a question, but I can comment. You said the Francis Bacon story, he didn't presuppose the change of human being, but what happened after that was, after the Industrial Revolution, in a sense, our life has totally changed.
Yes.
And our life has prolonged, so in a sense, we changed ourselves.
Yes.
So this happens very often. So this.
Yes, no, exactly. No, but I do, in a sense, the point about Francis Bacon wasn't directed to people who know something about the history, but rather it was directed to the people who are opposed, in principle, to any kind of human enhancement, who somehow think that there is this kind of natural human being, right, that needs to be preserved, right, in some way, and that therefore enhancement is a bad thing. And I think that kind of thinking, which is often gets called by the transhumanists as bioconservatism, right, that there's some kind of natural way of being human. I think that you're absolutely right, that certainly starting with the Industrial Revolution and with the rise of modern medicine, all of this stuff just does not make any sense from a theoretical or historical standpoint. Now, I think that the other question, the first question you were raising about Monsanto and genetically modified organisms, it's a problem, though I guess I would say that I would try to detach the problem of Monsanto being a multinational corporation with all kinds of interests and involvements with people, I would separate that from whether we should be having genetically modified organisms, where I think actually, to be honest with you, I don't see what the problem, I don't think there would be a problem if it weren't a multinational that was gaining most of the profits from it. And I do think that these two issues often get conflated together, and that maybe this is where a strong state or a strong super state could actually be doing something creative here, rather than, as it were, banning a certain innovative form of science because the innovators happen to be a multinational corporation. I think what you'd want to do is perhaps set up some kind of tax or regulatory regime, right, but nevertheless allow the thing to happen. That would be my view about this. But I see the advancement of genetically modified organisms not necessarily tied to the future of Monsanto. It seems to me historically those two things are connected together, but one can be against Monsanto and still not be against genetically modified organisms. These are two separate issues, it seems to me. And this is where the state can play an important constructive role in making sure that business doesn't monopolize things and all the rest of it, but without killing innovation. I mean, is that so weird? That seems to be like a You know, and I think at the moment, a lot of the sentiment against genetically modified organisms is simply against the political economy supporting it. That's what I mean, it's not about the science. It's about the political economy of it. I mean, look, and you know, this is the other thing, too. Again, this is where I think one has to kind of give the logic of capitalism some of its due, namely that who are going to take the risks initially, right? This is always the point that entrepreneurs, the whole defense of entrepreneurs, who takes the risk initially, right? Not surprisingly, those who are out there up in front end up gaining a lot of the capital from the initial things and then want to control the whole field after that. And that's when the problems start in capitalism, and that's why you need regulation of monopolies and you need all of those regulation of business practices and things like that. But what you don't want to do is to stop innovation in the process. But you want to manage it. That would be, it seems to me, the way to go. And that's been that has been the success of you know, not just of neoliberalism. This is a success of all socialist economies have depended on this as well.
Innocent, I'm just against the innovation. So actually, we don't need that innovation because.
But we've always been genetically modifying organisms. You were saying we've always been changing our bodies. We've always been genetically modifying organisms. All these things have always been happening.
We don't need that extreme innovation.
How? I mean, what's extreme?
Who decided we need this innovation? And so think about slow food movement. So simply, people started to deny.
Are we going to have slow food movement in India?
Yeah. No, Italy.
Oh, in Italy, sure, but India is another matter. No, because part of the move for genetically modified organisms was part of the development policy agenda too.
But what happened, for example, in the 80s, Japanese were confident in the technology. There was the argument of artifact engineering because up to then we, in a sense, believed in the innovation itself. So we believe that innovation itself is a good thing, but the great leader, Professor Yoshikawa, he became the president of the University of Tokyo. He believes that the innovation now is a little bit too much. So we need a kind of, in a sense, artifact management. So what you said is that innovation is risk-taking is, from its origin, it's a good thing, but I don't think it's a good thing. We can select it.
Well, you could select. I mean, you could select it to a certain extent. I mean, but I do think there's a fundamental issue about whether you're encouraging people to take risks, and I think that's a fundamental kind of societal cultural decision. How you manage the consequences of risk, that's an important question. And
taking a risk is sort of a very modern idea. So, taking a risk originated in the sailors who went to the abroad, and they decide to get profit, or risk-taking is nice. And it's this kind of idea is very new from the
group. Well, the fact that something's new is not, I mean, it's only new in the long term of history, but
so it's kind of ideology, we need risk-taking.
The whole idea of talking about risk as being positive or negative is modern, okay? I mean, I don't think people quite have this kind of rigorous conceptualization that we have, that we need risk thresholds beyond which then things become too risky. That's a very, Enlightenment idea.
But it's a different story, but risk-taking is to get profit as the beginning of modern society. And
yes.
Risk-taking is a nature of, in the sense, at the center of we shouldn't be modern anymore.
the notion behind taking risks is no different than the idea that we should experiment, namely that everything that we so why do you do experiments in science? Well, because all the things that we have seen so far may not necessarily represent all there is, and there may be some stuff that if we just sort of do things a little bit differently, we'll discover whole new things that will in fact empower us in ways that we haven't been before. And this was Francis Bacon's argument. This involves risk, okay? That process, that mentality that goes beyond observation but encourages experimentation involves a willingness to take risk and to say everything that's already happened isn't all there is. There is more. There is an untapped potential. And you can see then how the development of science and the development of capitalism kind of come from that same mentality, right? And it seems to me that's already there in Francis Bacon, and there's nothing in particular wrong with that as long as the consequences are managed. Okay? And I think the problems with capitalism come about because the consequences aren't managed properly. And so then the people who do immediately gain profit are able to endlessly gain profit and become bigger and bigger and crowd out others from ever getting involved in the process. Just like with the Kuhnian paradigm, right? The first guy to make the discovery ends up getting, you know, establishing the paradigm, and then everybody has to work under him, otherwise they can't do business in the discipline.
I don't know, something Francis Bacon didn't expect is the emergence of the United States. And what you talk is just like American attitude, risk taking, and so many ancestors of you left the continent simply to take risk to get bigger, but this is American attitude, and we are not American, so Japanese and European people, we are not so much interested in taking risk. So what
entrepreneurship is a European idea. Entrepreneurship is a European idea.
So this is
it's not an American idea.
This is a collapsing idea of Austro-Hungarian monarchy. So Schumpeter was, in the, so he left the Austria to the United States, so by Germany. So
yeah,
they were not accepted on the continent.
Well,
but anyway, so I will open the talk to you. I have many things to say against him. But
yes.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Izumi. I'm director of one of the funding program with JSD. Mm-hmm. Particularly concerning about the looking for solution for social issues caused by the, for example, in Japan, decreasing population,
right.
Aging population, and increase the criminal acts or something like that. And also we are funding the research, funding for the research projects about to enhance the so-called low carbon society.
Yes.
And also the disaster prevention and mitigation for in enhancing the so-called resilience.
Yes.
Resilience.
Yes.
Okay. So first of my question is, perhaps that is for the professor. what do you translate in Japanese? The word reactionary imperative and humanity 2.0.
ヒューマニティは人間性ですよ。プロアクショナリーっていうのは多分訳語がないんですよね。でもまあある程度こう一般的な用語になってますけども、だからプレ、後者なりは予防的とかなんかそういう前向きじゃないですか。プロアクション前向き。プロアクティブってなんですけど、プロアクショナリーっていうのは結構造語に近いことなんです。で、まあ要するに積極的にこう実験していくみたいなのがプロアクション。
Some of my colleagues who are here on the first part of this seminar, joined the yesterday seminar, and they gave to me the presentation of Professor Fura, and they translated that was in Japanese, Kodo Yusen Mere. Then, my question addressing Professor, what do you say about the method of production of new knowledge in the context of the so-called Gibbons mode one science and mode two science under the such situation you mentioned as the situation of precautionary to proactionary.
Well, that's tricky because the way I understand that distinction, and this actually does appear in this Kuhn book of mine, the mode one knowledge production was actually kind of understood to be something like a Kuhnian paradigm, where the academics are just doing knowledge in the normal science kind of way. And the point of Mode 2 was to bring so-called external considerations to bear on how people define the scientific research agenda. Now, that distinction, right, so this book is published in 1994, that distinction, it seems, still presupposed there was a strong, as it were, dividing line between academic research and non-academic world, right? So it presupposed a kind of Kuhnian world, right? Except that it was kind of saying good things about what was outside of Kuhn. But now I think the situation is kind of different. So I don't actually think of the Mode 1, Mode 2 as very helpful for the world we live in. So in terms of what I was talking about, both precautionary and proactionary are Mode 2, I would say. Right? And I think what you know, that they have different consequences for how Mode 1 operates. Right? But I think both of them are Mode 2 in the sense that they are both talking about the relevance of knowledge to society. That's kind of the primary orientation. And they're so the precautionary people basically say we have to produce knowledge that is safe for society, that in some sense protects the society. I understand protection to be a different notion from resilience. You mentioned resilience. I see resilient as closer to the proactionary idea, because resilience implies that there are going to be some harms, right? Things aren't, you're not going to be able to prevent certain bad consequences, but it becomes important that you recover from them, right? And that's what the proactionary principle is about that, right? And maybe resilience is a more polite way of talking about it. But it seems to me the proactionary principle is about this kind of resilience. Yeah. I mean, see, what part of the background here, I think, is that a lot of people still, even today, think that if something is scientific, the knowledge is certain and guaranteed, right? And that the only thing we should be basing policy on is certain science, because that will then make sure nothing bad happens. I think there's still some people, perhaps, who believe this. And I think the precautionary principle caters to this, right? The precautionary principle, in a way, kind of wants to use science in that way. Namely, if our science isn't settled, then we shouldn't be going there. We want to wait for the scientific consensus for agreement. You know, so for example, precautionary principle nowadays is very closely tied with the global warming issue, right? Because you got, 95% of scientists who agree that the planet is warming up, 2 degrees centigrade and so forth. That becomes grounds for precaution, right? It's a radical thing that they're asking for, the global warming people, but it's based on the scientific consensus, because the scientific consensus is being seen as a kind of certain foundation for knowledge. Now, my view is that's the wrong way to think about science. That in a sense, the scientific consensus issue is something that can change overnight. Okay? So in other words, you should not base your policy on the idea of a scientific consensus. Because the consent. So one of the things that's interesting, okay, is that some of the people, the older people who are now involved in the global warming business, if you go back 25 years when they were younger, they were talking about nuclear winter. Right, they were talking about a new ice age coming about because a nuclear war that took place was going to create this haze over the planet that was going to lower the temperatures. And some of those are exactly the same people. And those people, Stephen Schneider at the University of Colorado, who recently died, was one person who was very active in the 70s and very active in the first decade of this century. And he went from nuclear winter to global warming. Why? Because the evidence changed. Okay? I'm not saying these people are charlatans or anything. They're just being scientists. Okay? And the consensus can go from one extreme to the other extreme as the evidence changes. So the point here is that if you're going to wait for scientific consensus to set your policy, you've got to understand that science will change its consensus over time. And if you say the world's going to be warming up within the next 50 years, in the next 25 years, the theory will have changed. Okay? And I think you always have to have that in mind. Right? So the relationship between science and policy is a really very complicated thing. And that's why you have to always... A scientific consensus will not protect you from risk. Let's put it that way. A scientific consensus will not protect you from risk. is just an affirmation of faith in science, but it's not protecting you from risk, given what we know of the history of science. And that's why I think the resilience path of the proactionary principle is a better way to go in terms of dealing with science and dealing with policy. Because then you expect to change. You expect to change. Yeah.
New responsibility of people.
That's right.
To become the co-owner of science. I think what you were basically saying was that people need to become the participants of biological.
Yes.
Participants of biological experiments from the beginning of their life. Is that the idea?
There is something. Yeah. I mean, the view is. It's kind of complicated, but ideally, yes, that would be, but it wouldn't be something. I mean, as you were pointing out to me, with regard to this, my view is a little complicated because, and I mentioned this a little bit yesterday, I don't believe it is reasonable to force people to participate in these risky experiments. You know, certainly as young people and so forth. However, I do think that society ought to be subsidizing the risk takers. So the people who do not take the risks, because look, if let's say you loosened ethical regulations and you allow a lot more risky experimentation to happen, how many people would actually want to do this? Well, maybe 10%, maybe 20%, but not the whole population, okay? But of course, those 10 or 20% of people are really taking risks on behalf of everyone if we're talking about science. Because whether the results are good or bad, we learn something from this that will then benefit further research that will then benefit everyone. And so for that reason, I believe the people who do not take the risks ought to be subsidizing the ones who do take the risks. Okay, so you don't, it's not like I'm saying you must take risks, you must do risky experiments. But you should subsidize those who are willing to do so in a more liberalized experimental regime, because you will benefit from the consequences of it while someone else is taking the risks. So it's a kind of a, you know, cross-subsidization through the tax system, that part of what your taxes would pay for would be for those who put themselves forward to take risks. And I see this, and the way I do talk about it a little bit in the book, is like national service. You know, like going into the military to defend your country. Not everyone does it, right? People volunteer to do it. Only in wartime are people forced to do it, okay? But everyone benefits, and so people are willing to pay a certain amount of their taxes for defense, right? Even though they themselves, you know, someone else is doing it on their behalf, basically. And I think this is the way you have to look at the co-ownership of the science, okay? It has to be that way. And in other words, it has to go beyond just merely having a critical interest in science. Because I think the way we talk about public participation in science very often is really kind of at the level of the spectator, that you should know about it, you should be able to say something negative about it in a newspaper, you know, or something. But I'm talking about something more substantial than that. I'm talking about participating in the actual production of knowledge, which has the potential for transforming the kinds of beings that we are. Okay, yeah. You can go ahead. Yeah.
I have a concern about the reproduction of human beings in this humanity 2.1 society, because in that kind of society, people will be forced into the situation of
what, forced against their will?
Yes, because because of the for example, the decisions that their parents.
Oh, I see. Well.
There will be a new race that
But I, you know, I understand what you're saying. I actually don't think the genetics really work that well. I mean, I think there's a sense in which the more we learn about genetics and the way in which genetics are influenced by the environment and about, I actually think it's going to be harder and harder. I think this idea that you can actually manufacture the kind of children you want exactly and get them the way that you want them to be, I think our ability to do that genetically will be no better than our ability to do it in the normal ways, like putting them to certain schools, giving them a certain diet, right? In other words, there are all kinds of other probabilities involved, even at the genetic level, that I don't think you can guarantee results in the kind of way you're worried about, okay? So in other words, even if we were to find, let's say, a gene that if you manipulate it in a certain way raises people's IQ by 10 points or something. Let's say that was possible, okay? What are the effects of that with regard to the other genes? What other things will happen to that person even if they lead a, quote, normal life? We really don't know that, right, until the person has lived, right? Just like sending your kids to the best school or giving your kids the best diet, which already happens, okay? Parents are already doing that. We don't worry about compromising free will there. Okay, we think the parents are doing a good job when they do stuff like that. And yet the results of that aren't determined either, right? Kids can be raised very well and still end up in completely crazy fashion. So I think what we need to be more concerned about in this kind of world of genetic manipulation is the variation that we produce. It's the variation. In other words, I think with genetics, you have the potential of creating a wider range of people in terms of capacities and incapacities that will make it which will be a challenge to the tolerance levels of our society. And you were alluding to this in your presentation and my talk. And that's more of the question, okay? And I'll just give you one context where I think this matters. Disability, okay? One of the things that people always talk about when they say, oh my God, you know, genetically manipulating kids, you'll have a master race, and then there'll be all these, people who will be regarded as disabled because they're not up to that level, that superior level. I don't actually think it's going to go that way. And certainly not in the current legal regimes, because at the moment, in order to, you know, if you think about the various kinds of adventurous biomedical treatments, prosthetic devices, drugs, etc. The people who are most easily eligible for them are people who are disabled as ways of restoring, right? The idea is that it restores them in some way, so then you allow them to have these rather extreme treatments that you wouldn't allow normal, quote, normal people to have. And so, you know, we get Oscar Pistorius and, you know, all these people who are around who have these kind of things. Now, there's a report out, I just mentioned this as a parenthesis, there is a report that's been put out by the Brookings Institution, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., a liberal think tank, called Our Cyborg Future. And one of the things that they're imagining is that as there are more and more, quote, disabled people who are restored by these very adventurous treatments, genetically or prosthetically, right, and they gain, as a result of, quote, restoration, additional powers. So Oscar Pistorius, right, his legs are in some sense restored, but he can do things that normal people can't do, that this will create actually a demand within the abled society to want to become cyborgs. In other words, people will be happy to have their limbs cut and put the artificial stuff in if it enables them to have these new powers. And so the idea that the attractiveness, right, of this kind of cyborg existence, so that people who in the past would have been seen as disabled and somehow restored would now be seen as providing a new sense of desirability, okay? And of course, if you look at the way in which movies and the media present this stuff, this is not so hard to imagine. And so I'll stop after this. There's a part of London, East London, called Shoreditch, which is a very funky place with a lot of design people and stuff in it. And what they hold every month a cyber salon, and you can see it on YouTube, you can find it. I participated in this last year, one of these cyber salons, 6 people on the panel, 3 of them cyborgs. And it was about this business of the way in which having all these cyborgs around are changing our notions of human identity and human normalcy. And so we all did our presentations. And so afterwards, the guy who was the chair of the session asked the members of the audience, you know, how many of you would be willing to trade your able-bodied limbs or whatever to get one of these things these guys have? And it was a good 20%. It was a good 20%, especially younger people. Especially younger people, right? The people who you would think are the most abled, right? They, you know, they do it, okay? And I think, you know, so there is a kind of an appetite in the environment to be willing to experiment with, you know, the constitution of the human being, okay? And so people are already thinking about how are we going to manage this, right? How are we going to manage this? Because in a sense, people are already kind of in their own mind transgressing this difference between restoring and enhancing. This is being transgressed all the time without anyone having to make an argument, just by seeing the attractiveness of the cyborgs. I mean, in Britain, you do hear a lot of people saying very nice things about Stephen Hawking, right, as a being, not just that he's a smart guy, okay? So I think this is a very tricky, I think in a sense, the climate may be actually more pushing us in this direction than one might think. Did you have anything else? I'm sorry. Did you have another question?
I still have a sense that humanity 1.0 is putting human into the situation that is controlled by technology before we know the capacity of human beings as it is. So, like Oscar Pistorius.
Yeah, sure. He's not a great role model. No.
Well, what can I say?
Yes. No. I know what you say.
Technology. So yes, there is a will. There is a desire of people to become. To enhance their ability, but before trying to enhance the ability of human beings, we need to know what we can do without technology. And it is not only technology that enable people to
enhance us just in case of GMOs. Yeah. Actually, we have excess of food on the earth, but GMO people said this is to save the starving people. It's just the opposite. And what Steve is talking about is stand only for technology. We can opt out. But in case of GMOs, or just like a Down syndrome test, this is a kind of, in a sense, obligatory thing, so technology autonomy. So we can't decline, for example, GMOs anymore because no sign on it. And Monsanto emphasized this is safe, maybe safe, but I don't like it because this is a starting point of quite similar in nuclear power station. No accident happened for many years, but suddenly there was a critical point and it changed. We found it's dangerous. So, but now we are in nuclear society, so we can't opt out it. So
yeah,
so,
you know, you, so this you, point.
You, mm-hmm. you, what you are talking this about self decision making. So of course, we know that cyborg. So for example, Paralympic is much more powerful than Olympic, and so if you want to be run fast, disabled people are much better situation because they have robotics. And if you see Paralympics, it is materialized. It is in front of you. It's not a story, but in case of GMOs or climate change, can we opt out?
Well, I mean, this yesterday when we had the workshop yesterday, I brought up this concept, which is relevant. I mean, in terms of how you think about your problem, because it's an open question in my mind, at least. is it adaptive preference formation, which comes from social psychology. And it's the idea that it's kind of addressing the worry you have, right? Namely, if you do introduce a technology, right, there are usually lots of objections to introducing a new technology, especially if it's a radical technology. And the objections turn out to be the one, and they persist. But the problem is, the longer you're used to the technology and you're living with it, the harder and harder it becomes. Those objections don't count so much anymore.
No, in Japanese case, catastrophe came. Mm-hmm. So finally, Fukushima exploded. So we were so used to...
Yeah, but even when the catastrophe comes... No, because if you look at the... So the example that's used is the example of the automobile, right? People knew in 1900 that the automobile was going to destroy the environment. You didn't have to be a genius to know that back in 1900, if you thought that everybody would have a car, Henry Ford was saying he was going to make them cheap enough so people could have them. He was announcing this, okay? And so you knew what was down the road. They knew that in 1900. But people bought the cars. The pollution did come. The environment did get destroyed. But by the time that happened, people's values had changed, so that even though they did believe in the environment in some sense...
We can argue this eternally, so I can get prepared the counter example. So, if you have a question from another aspect,
Actually, two questions. Thank you for talking. First is about singularity. So, because last year or the year before last year, there was a famous cosmic cause named A Brief History of Mankind, and I think last year that the teacher just published a book about that course. And in the last chapter of the book, he said very similar things that you said today, to what you said today. But he was quite pessimistic about the fate of human beings. He said, when the singularity comes, then Homo sapiens stop to be being, to be exist anymore, and there's another form of being, like humanity 2.0 or something. But he didn't mention the word. Mm-hmm. So he is quite pessimistic about the fate of human beings. The message that he delivered, at least, seems like that. And I have a question about because he said that before singularity, we have this kind of life, but after singularity, it seems like what happened before singularity is totally irrelevant to what happens after that, after singularity, right? After singularity, people don't really care about what's before them. So the people living in humanity 2.0 age may have no interest in the people living in humanity 1.0. So I have a question. Since if that singularity exists, well, maybe in this century, then what are we doing here and what we will be doing for maybe several decades seems quite meaningless, right, to the story after.
Okay.
So that's the first question.
Yeah. Okay, let me answer this one and then you go for the second one?
Sure.
Because otherwise I'll forget the first one and it's a big question. It's true. Again, this goes back to the point about, you know, who's part of this singularity. I mean, that it's true that one of the things that we have to contemplate as we imagine that people are going to take this singularity stuff seriously is that it does lead to radical changes in lifestyle. So if people do opt for, let's say, having their consciousness uploaded into machines, and that's the way they want to exist, how can those beings live with ordinary human beings? They would seem to have very little in common in terms of how they're maintained or something like that. Okay, so and in the proactionary imperative, I do kind of I take that seriously, and I'd say that's why one of the biggest social challenges for a society that takes something like the singularity seriously will be to how can you have a liberal society under those circumstances? We actually tolerate beings who remain humanity 1.0, right? Because you're saying there will be no interest in such beings and so forth. Well, how do you organize a political system that actually allows the tolerance? That's one issue. But in terms of this, the history that you're portraying, I don't think this is such an unusual narrative structure. Because when we talk about human exceptionalism, which is what all this goes back to, what makes human beings different, right? Julian Huxley, when he coined the term transhumanism, he was giving us a story that went something like this. Namely, we descended from the apes and the lower animals, but then at some point, we became different. right? And for him, the difference had to do with our ability not only to follow evolution, but to know the theory, right? To understand how it works and therefore control it. And that then separated us off from animals, okay? And the thing, and then you think about, what do human beings think about animals? We descended from them, but it actually, there's been a very long battle in human history to actually keep a sustained interest in animals, right? Other than working for us in some way. And I think the issue that you're raising with regard to the singularity and the humanity 1.0 might be sort of similar, okay? Where in a sense, it's kind of like the way humans think about apes, the way in which these humanity 2.0 people think about humanity 1.0 people, okay? And it's something that we're gonna have to struggle with, just like we have to struggle with the recognition of animals, okay? But I do think it's not unprecedented, let's put it that way. I think in a sense we have already been dealing with this problem if we think of ourselves as the finished product of creation, looking at everything that came before us.
A quick follow-up to what you just said. I think to put it more concretely, what is the meaning of teaching people this humanity courses? Like, is it still necessary to read those Greek books?
Sure.
I mean, for people living humanity 1.0 age, that's quite relevant, but...
Well, no, but look, I mean, it seems to me that those Greek books, if you recall, they include works of Aristotle and people like this. They don't just talk about other human beings, right? Those books are talking about everything in some sense, and they're setting up, as it were, the framework by which we became the kinds of creatures we did. But all of those books actually do talk about the other stuff that aren't Homo sapiens too, okay? It's not like the great books are just about, they're for, you might say, our humanization, but they're not just about it, okay? Aristotle did believe human beings were the top animal, but that didn't stop him from talking about animals and what our relationship to them is and all the rest of it. And so I think this is, I think what we do need to do and is that we actually need to normalize transhumanist discourse within our humanities, and that to realize that transhumanism isn't just some weird thing that was invented by science fiction, but actually is a pretty normal development from the way in which our understanding of human progress has taken place throughout the modern era. You know, and in this respect, I give you, you're right, if you want to get rid of modernity, that's the best way to get rid of transhumanism, is to get rid of modernity. But if you don't want to get rid of modernity, then in a sense, this is the next step.
No, redefinition of modernity, it's my strategy. But anyway, I'm afraid...
I'm sorry,
we don't have much time to go to the second question.
Oh, sorry.
So time is almost up, and could you talk to each other the privately?
Okay.
So, thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you, everybody.
This whole debate.